You guys gotta come with the lyrics. Hi everyone, welcome back to another week of Cheetah Talk Time. And I mean, this is a very exciting month, and this means all our episodes are gonna be very exciting because it's Black History Month.
Woo! I mean, our episodes are always exciting.
And they feel more exciting. Anyway, this week we chose two black figures, one in Tudor history and one in Georgian history.
To spice it up a bit.
It's yeah, funny. And also just to like get some Tudor rap, Georgian rap, yeah. You know? So the first person we're going to look at is Mary Phyllis. And I think just like big thanks to Miranda Kaufman,
our
friend, for doing so much research into this. And this is like the first research that we have into Black Tudors. Is her book, Black Tudors.
It's a really great read, and it focuses on multiple different people. And what I really love about it is that they're all normal people. I mean, especially on this podcast, to focus on, you know, the aristocracy, etc. And these are just genuine, regular people. And I think that's why it's especially interesting.
So, Mary Phyllis was born in Morocco, actually, in around 1577, and she was the daughter of Phyllis of Morisco. He was a Moroccan troublemaker.
And her mother was a basket weaver. Those are such cool trades, sorry.
Well, I think that's maybe where the name Phyllis comes from, because it meant some sort of long straw that you would have wove baskets with.
Wow. We don't really know much about Mary Phyllis's early life, but it seems that she left Morocco at a very young age of only about 6 years old. And we don't really know the circumstances under which she left her home and her family behind.
Well, I was just going to say, one theory on how she arrived in England is with the English merchants who sort of began trade with North Africa and Morocco in the 1580s. So this is a possible way in which she came over to England.
So I mean, I feel like we don't really learn how prominent trade with Morocco was for the English economy especially. By 1576, this trade was worth about £17,775, which is the equivalent of £3.3 million today, and was twice the value of somewhere like Portugal, which we already had very important trade with. And it just kind of shows how important this connection, you know, with Morocco and trade with Morocco was. And that's most likely how she came over, because she's first recorded living in central London on Mark Lane near the Tower of London. The website I was on had a map and they were like, she lived here. And I was like, this feels stalkerish but also really cool. As a servant in the household of merchant John Barker, I said that, didn't I? Anyway, but he was involved in this trade, so that's kind of why the connection comes up.
She was not the only African servant in the Barker household. And we also had Laying Muia. Lara can decide which one you like. A man called George, and then another servant of about 20 years old. And they were all working there by the sort of early 1590s. So we can sort of see the sort of commonality of African servants coming over to England.
And it was the distinction that they were servants, not slaves.
They did get paid. Debatable how much. Yeah. And
conditions were probably still.
But it wasn't slavery.
Phyllis worked there for a number of years, but I think probably one of the reasons we picked her is because she actually became more than just a kind of average servant in a household. You know, I think that's really why we picked focus on her. Because by 1597, we know she had moved to working in a different household so she was about 20 at this time. In 1597, we have record of her getting baptized.
On June 3rd.
She got baptized at St. Botolph's Aldgate. And in the parish register, it listed her as working for a Millicent Porter, who was a seamstress living in
Smithfield.
It's clear that these two women had become very close, because when Phyllis did decide to get baptized, and I think it's also really important to recognize that it was a decision that she made. It's not like she wasn't actively forced, but because she left her home so young, it's unlikely that many of her like religious roots and culture would have stayed with her, so she would have, you know, naturally kind of adapted to more English culture, which you can take as you will. I mean, it's a little bit sad, but it's also kind of, you know, it's very much her own decision.
And she would have felt very ostracized in English society, so maybe being baptized was just like a little thing that could help her feel a bit more part of the civilization.
And it wasn't exactly uncommon for Africans in England to get baptized. I mean, there were more than 60 baptism records of Africans in this sort of this couple of years, which I think may not sound like a lot, but if you consider the proportion of people that had come over, like, it is a lot of people to have concrete records of.
Yeah, but the point, back to the point I was trying to make but really fumbled terribly, is that Millicent Porter became her godmother, and I think that clearly shows a very tight connection between the two of them.
Because she was in Morocco, and we have the Moors in Morocco, it's likely that she was born a Muslim, but she was only like 6 or 7 when she came to England, or maybe a little bit older than 6 or 7. No, I take it back. 6 or 7.
No,
good. My maths was wrong. But so she probably didn't retain much of that faith. And also, I don't remember if he said, but Millicent Porter, although she didn't force her to get baptized, she did still really encourage her faith and her Christianity. And it just seems that, well, in London, being baptized is sort of a must do if you want to really
bucket list.
It's top 10 things to do in London.
Top 10 things to do as a pious tourist in London
in 1597. Get baptized.
And the things like baptism, and if you wanted to be a real part of the club that was post Reformation Tudor society, you got a baptism. You basically said, "I'm here to stay."
While working for Millicent Porter, it seems that like her kind of the jobs and tasks that she would have done like definitely changed from the kind of trivial, probably quite mundane housekeeping chores she would have had to do in working for John Barker. While she would have still had to do some of them because Porter kept very small. She kept very minimal staff, but as a seamstress, it's most likely that Phyllis would have also been kind of taught the seamstress trade and been quite highly involved in, you know, the making of dresses and stuff. And I think that's quite cool.
Unfortunately, Millicent, Mary's godmother, died on the 28th of June in 1599, and from that we have no record of Mary.
The next person is Dido Elizabeth Bell.
So Dido Elizabeth Bell was the illegitimate daughter of Sir John Lindsay, who, yeah, he was an officer in the Royal Navy, and an African woman named White Man, Maria Bell, who we think is around 15 at the time of giving birth. So don't be fooled into thinking this is some love story. It is very much pedophilia. So the first record that we have of Maria, Dido's mum, is on Dido's own baptism entry, which was in around 1766 at St. George's Church in Bloomsbury. So Maria Bell is noted as the mother of Dido when she was baptised at 5 years old. Lindsay is not recorded as the father, but he hopefully did support Maria over the next years, or at least he sort of kept chatting with her, kept in contact.
Well, so between 1757 and 1767, Lindsay was sailing off the coast of West Africa and the West Indies, which is when the two met. And we don't know for sure how they met or the context of their relationship, but all we do know is that a pregnant Maria was shipped back to England by boat, where she gave birth to her daughter, Dido. But then Dido is taken in by her great uncle, naturally, William Murray, future Earl of Mansfield, sorry, spoilers, at Kenwood House.
That's in Hampstead Heath. I don't know if it's still there, but it was in Hampstead Heath. In London, London.
Anyway,
it's very rare for a mixed race child to be raised as a part of the British aristocracy, but she was. She was taught to read and write and play music, and it was said that she was very graceful and she was very good with guests, and she received an annual allowance. So really, they are actually raising her as one of their own.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, to an extent, but the thing is, Maria Dido's mother wasn't really that involved in her life, and we don't know or understand exactly why it was. It could have been that she was kept from seeing her, like, as in kept from seeing her daughter, that they didn't want Dido to, like, you know, I don't know, like, catch culture from Maria or something. But, or if it was just that she didn't feel ready for motherhood, and that's why she allowed herself to be kept away from her daughter for so long, because she was as young as 15 when she had her. But it definitely seems like there was something slightly fishy going on, in my opinion, because in 1774, when Maria did leave England for America, where she built a house for herself in Pensacola on a plot of land given to her by Lindsay. So it does slightly seem like he was like, here's some land all the way across the ocean. Go play. But Dido remained at Kenwood and grew up in with the companionship of her cousin Elizabeth Murray. And she was brought up as her cousin's equal. Like Laura said, you know, they were both taught to read, write, play music, in the same way that all aristocratic young ladies were. Her allowance was £30 per year, and an additional 5 guineas for her birthday every year. It is also worth noting, though, I feel like we're talking a lot about like how they seem to be equal, but her cousin received a much greater allowance of £100 per year. But this could quite possibly have been much more to do with Dido's illegitimate status, as her parents weren't married, rather than the colour of her skin. But it also, that very well could have played a factor within it.
And Dido did also carry out these sort of common hobbies for noble women at the time. I mean, she supervised Kenwood's dairy and poultry yard. And so it does show that there was a lot of trust in her. She was respected, but I mean, her activities did change quite significantly after Lady Mansfield died in 1784. And then when her cousin Elizabeth Murray married in 1785, and she was off being a wife. And so poor Dido had to stay at Kenwood without her cousin. And she was in her 20s, and so she just kind of became a sort of nurse, really, to Lord Mansfield. We don't know for certain whether, like, the change in Lord Mansfield's opinion on the slave trade is to do with Dido, but I think it's quite likely. But there was a trial at 1772, very long, very complicated, but if you just sort of sum it up, he described slavery as odious. So showing that he isn't really in support of it, which I think is quite, it's the bare minimum, really. Not going to give him a pat on the back.
But at
least it's the bare minimum. At least we're not below the bare minimum. But he had to then still adhere to the law, so it's below the bare minimum, really. But this was a significant sort of stepping stone, if you will, into the road of abolishing slavery. It didn't end it, but it was like,
I think the other case that he presided over, that Mansfield presided over, which has often been singled out in history as an important road, as an important like part on the road to the abolition of slavery, is the Zong slave ship case in 1783. And I think that her influence is like not completely obvious, but the main thing about this case is viewing slaves as people rather than just objects. That's the main thing, and I think maybe his, you know, not affiliation, but his just emotional connection with her just made them just humanize them a bit for him. But I'll just quickly explain this case. It's a really horrific case. So basically, during the voyage to Jamaica, the Zong was a boat. The Zong's captain and crew threw at least 120 black men, women, and children overboard although it's been estimated to be as many as 142. Most of them still shackled because the crew claimed they were running low on fresh water. It's even worse when you consider that the first time this case went to court, it was not considered murder, but it was instead considered something that the insurers had to pay for as lost cargo. Basically, then during an appeal, which is what Mansfield oversaw, he decided that this was in fact a crime and actually viewed them as living people. I mean, the wording isn't great. The wording isn't great of the jury there, because they say they had no doubt that the case of slaves was the same as if horses had been thrown overboard, and they're basically saying that, like, they're not. It's not like you lost some fruit. They're saying, like, that's a living, breathing thing that you decided to throw overboard. And so this time, the judges, led by Mansfield, finally ruled that the captain and crew had been at fault and that this was... this was not a crime, but it wasn't fully... No one was ever actually charged... It was ruled that it was murder, but no one was actually charged with the murder, specifically. But yeah, that's a bit of a downer, but I think that was seen as really... That one, as well, is seen as really, really important in kind of change in terms of legislation and stuff and, like, how they were viewed. Anyway...
Dido is living kind of at the time when the slave trade is probably at its height, but that is when people's opinions do start to change. And, like, of course, Britain is very economically reliant on slave labour in the Caribbean, in American colonies, but there was a change in tone from the public. And the fact that Mansfield was the Lord Chief Justice and had, like, the most important, powerful judicial position in England means that actually, even if his legislative changes were quite minor, the fact that there is someone kind of at the top not supporting it, he did lead a bit of a movement against the slave trade, and you can you can bring that back to her, perhaps, if you believe it was down to her.
It's definitely a kind of, it's a big thing for him to do, even though it seems so, like, not trivial, but almost a given now that obviously these are, like, in the Zong case, like, obviously these are people, but for him to say that and view them not as cargo was, like, a really, really big thing back then. But unfortunately, in 1793, he died. And in his will, he left Dido an annual,
annuity,
which I think is just like an annual kind of, like, as in she has to, so she doesn't spend her inheritance all in one go. It's like a kind of, like, annually she gets this much money. So she gets £100 of annuity and a lump sum, which I think is just kind of given to her in one go, of £500, which is the equivalent of £40,000 in today's money. But probably the most important line for Dido was a single line which read, "I do confirm Dido Elizabeth Bell her freedom." Now, obviously, she was a free woman. She'd been born a free woman. But I think what Mansfield was basically doing here is, like, legally securing her freedom and trying to protect her and prevent her from any ambiguity of what her status in society was after his death.
Yeah. And after this, she married a steward named John and Davinia. The couple went on to have three sons, twin boys, Charles and John, and then another son, William Thomas, who were all baptised.
She left Kenwood, and the new couple moved to 40. I have their exact address. moved to 14 Ranelagh Street North, near St George's Hanover Square. If you want to go visit,
if you live there now, send us a text.
Yeah, let us know. I want to know. Anyway, after Mansfield's death, Dido no longer enjoyed the elite status she once had. But she was very comfortable, you know, well off. They're just not kind of, you know, running with, like, the social elite in society. But she was still comfortable and well off. And yeah, she died in 1804 in Pimlico at the age of 43.
We tend to lose track of the rest of her line after her sons.
So before we finish on Dido, we just quickly wanted to talk about, there's this portrait of her and her cousin, and the really important thing about this portrait is that it is so different to lots of other pieces from history that depict a black woman, because she is the focus of the painting. Well, she's not the focus, she's one of the main, there's two focuses, she's one of them, and in this painting it sets itself apart because the black person in question is not depicted as like, or like an ornament or subservient to the white sitter. In this case, they are basically somewhat equal. So Dido is expensively dressed in what is most likely an ivory satin dress, jewels, and she has a really beautiful turban on and a really beautiful pearl necklace. But the women aren't entirely equal, because Dido is positioned behind Elizabeth, and Dido's outfit, you know, with the turban, the ostrich feathers, the train of fruit, is much more meant to symbol that she is perceived as exotic just because of the way she looks. And then you contrast that to her cousin, who's sitting right next to her, has a very conventional dress for the time. But I think what's really important about this is that Dido is not a prop in this painting. She's a human being, and she instantly draws your attention, despite being behind Elizabeth. I would say when I first saw it, my, like, just the way her character is depicted in it, like, she seems to have, like, energy in her eyes and face and stuff. Your eyes are drawn more to her, I would argue, personally, than they are to Elizabeth. And that's why this painting is really interesting, and probably why we have such a good record of her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the point of us doing these two women was, I think, I read a book by Sathyanam Sangera, and he was basically talking about how there have been people of colour in England, in London, for so much longer than we're taught, and we're not really taught that they were here during Tudor times or Georgian times, and that's why there's this whole culture of people of colour have, like, are almost not at home here, or that, like, they've come and imposed themselves. And if we were just taught that actually they've been here for hundreds of years, then it might create a culture where we're a lot more accepting and welcoming. Yeah. But yeah, thank you all for listening.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed, so, and we'll see you next week on Tudor Talk Time.